coming up on Philosophy Talk. Bargaining with the devil.
Critics say that concessions are a sign of weakness. Burke, however, says magnanimity in politics is not seldom the truest wisdom, and a great empire and little minds go ill together.
All government, indeed, every human benefit and enjoyment, every virtue and every prudent act is founded on compromise and barter.
This notion that by not talking to people we are punishing them has not worked.
Is it better to stand on principle and get nothing, or compromise and get something?
We should not just talk to our friends, we should be willing to engage our enemies as well. That's what diplomacy is all about.
Our guest is UC Irvine law professor and professional mediator, Carrie Minkle-Nettle.
Bargaining with the devil.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
After the news.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
Today, bargaining with the devil.
Well, Ken, bargaining with the devil, that's a catchy phrase. What it's supposed to bring to mind, I think, is the issue of bargaining and compromise. That is the moral issue of when and about what one should bargain and compromise.
Well, John, it's clear that bargaining and compromise are just essential for individuals that are a part of any social group at all. I mean, and nations that share a common world. No one gets their way all the time, except maybe dictators, but probably not even them.
But is it appropriate to compromise when you were right about something? When you're clearly right about something, and that something is very important.
Well, John, let's perform a thought experiment to test your intuitions here. You're an anthropologist. You're working in a nation that's racked by revolution. One of the leftist radical groups comes to the village in which you're working and rounds up 15 males and says they're going to execute them all. You protest. You say, you can't do that. He says, fine with us. If you shoot the first one, we'll let all the others go. He hands you the gun. Now, what do you do, John?
Well, I don't know how you know it's a leftist organization.
Okay, or a rightist organization.
Yeah, okay. Well, my principles are very much against killing innocent people. It's not something I like to do, and I managed to avoid it so far, I believe. In this case, though, I could save 14 innocent lives. Assuming I believe the guy, I'd probably shoot him. The utilitarian might approve. I guess the Kantian would disapprove.
Well, the Kantian would disapprove. But look, history is full of leaders who had to compromise with evil. So don't feel bad. Churchill refused to negotiate with Hitler, but he negotiated with Stalin. And he agreed, for example, to the forced repatriation of dissident Soviet refugees, among other things. And all those things that he agreed to with Stalin had really bad effects because Stalin was an evil dude.
Well, you know, when you think about it, Ken, our whole nation was founded on compromise. Many of our founding fathers, not only those from the northern states, but some of the slaveholding southerners as well, knew full well that slavery was wrong, just about as wrong as anything can be. But they compromised. They compromised away the life, liberty, and happiness of millions of African Americans in order to achieve union.
Political theorists like Avishai Margalit distinguish between two kinds of compromises, just plain compromises and what he calls rotten compromises. Rotten compromises are those that institute or perpetuate truly inhumane regimes. He says those kinds of compromise are morally prohibited, but he allows lots of other kinds of compromises.
Well, you know, that sounds reasonable. Margalit's a very smart guy, but it does seem like a rather high standard historically. I mean, looks like our founders' compromise was rotten. Looks like Churchill shouldn't have compromised with Stalin at Yalta. We probably shouldn't compromise with the Taliban, and we shouldn't be negotiating with North Korea.
But, you know, here's the problem. Inhumane regimes are a fact, and sometimes you just don't have an alternative to compromise. Can there really be a moral prohibition, an absolute moral prohibition against negotiating with them? And doesn't willingness to negotiate imply willingness to compromise?
As usual, Ken, we need some help. In a minute, we're going to be joined by Carrie Minkle-Nettle from the University of California, Irvine School of Law. She's the author of the book What's Fair? Ethics for Negotiators.
But first, a roving philosophical reporter, Molly Samuel, finds that in some bargains, it's not always clear who's a devil and who's an angel. She files this report.
San Benito County is wedged between San Francisco and the Monterey Peninsula. It's hot, dry, sunny, mostly an agricultural area.
We're noted in this county for earthquakes, for motorcycle rallies, and very recently the amount of sunshine that we get here.
Reb Minaco is a San Benito County supervisor. Their sunny weather has attracted the attention of the solar energy company SolarGen. They want to build one of America's largest solar farms in the remote Pinoche Valley.
There would be job creation for this area, income at some level for our county. And then more globally, when we look at it, we have agreed that we probably need to look at something besides fossil fuel energy. Wind and solar are a part of that.
The Board of Supervisors has voted to approve the project's environmental impact report, even though there are unanswered questions about the valley's endangered species. For instance, the blunt-nosed leopard lizard.
This species of animal is relatively rare, but no one really knows what the impact of solar panels will have on their breeding, and I believe that we need to move forward carefully and monitor that. I'm not opposed to saying, yeah, that's a valid way to find out.
Yeah, does that make sense? No.
Ron Garthwaite owns the Claravel Dairy in the Pinoche Valley. He does not think the solar farm is a good idea, and he definitely doesn't share Monaco's view that they can always fix problems as they go along.
I mean, it's like, you know, we had to destroy the valley to save it. It's that kind of mentality. These are our calves.
Garthwaite's dairy straddles the main road through the valley. His house is nestled between fruit trees, a vegetable garden, and a pistachio orchard. The calves live in a pen by the house, and across the street, cows eat hay behind the milking barn.
So would you be able to see the solar?
Yeah. Be right back there.
Garthwaite points across the valley. It's about 5 miles wide here. He says he doesn't trust SolarGen to make good on its promises to protect habitat and farmland. But he also doesn't think the San Benito County Board of Supervisors has necessarily made a deal with the devil. He does think they've made a deal at the wrong crossroads.
Obviously, solar's good. Who can argue about it? But where you put solar is a whole different thing. It's ridiculous. There are innumerable areas that have no endangered species, no ecological value, no agricultural value, no value whatsoever.
In San Benito County, people who support renewable energy are finding themselves pitted against people who want to protect endangered species and small-scale agriculture. Alex Levinson of the Sierra Club says it's new territory for environmentalists.
We have historically had relationships with a number of industries in which our primary posture was oppositional to them. With the solar industry, we wanted to succeed.
The key for the Sierra Club is to find a balance. Support solar, but not bad projects. Protect endangered species, but try to find ways to compromise.
There are going to be projects, many projects, that we're going to strongly support. And there are going to be some projects we're going to oppose. And there are going to be lots of projects where they start out with some problems and we can help improve them to a point where we can support them. Or at least say, you know, they've gotten to a point where we're not going to use our resources to oppose them.
Environmentalists in the Mojave Desert were disappointed recently when a solar farm that threatens desert tortoise habitat got the go-ahead. In the Pinoche Valley, there's no clear compromise. If the solar farms go in, the future of the blunt-nosed leopard lizard and Ron Garthwaite's dairy are unclear. If it doesn't, the county misses out on an opportunity to create jobs and generate renewable energy. Whether it turns out to be a devil or an angel may just depend on who you talk to. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Molly Samuel.
I'm John Perry, and with me is Ken Taylor.
And our guest is Carrie Minkle-Meadle. She's a professor of law from the University of California, Irvine. She's author of What's Fair? Ethics for Negotiators. Carrie, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks for having me.
Carrie, all lawyers need to know when and when not to compromise, at least the good ones. But for you, the issue of compromise has become a theoretical, even a philosophical preoccupation, a central topic. How did that come about?
Well, about 30 years ago, I was a lawyer for poor people on the East Coast, and we brought lots of big cases on the side of justice and good and the side of the angels. And we'd often win the lawsuits, so we'd get a victory, but then the case wouldn't be over because people would try to get out of what they had been ordered to do by the judges. And the situations often were much more complicated than just a yes-no, win-lose result. So I began looking at some very successful lawyers around me who just picked up the phone and started to try to get things done by negotiating. And that's become my life's work.
Now, you know, we're going to probably spend a good part of the hour talking about when not to compromise or when it might be wrong, morally wrong to compromise. But taking off on what you just said, maybe you should start out by giving us a summary of what's so good about compromise and why it's often the right thing to do.
Well, just think about your everyday average life. If you didn't compromise or avoid conflict or not fight about principles every minute of the day, you couldn't get through it. So I would just say that compromise is a necessity for human life. For us to prosper and flourish and get along with other people, we compromise every single minute. We just can't live, alas, the totally principled life.
Well, that seems, well, we can't live a totally principled life. Well, most of the compromises that you're faced with in everyday life, I hope, I think, are with reasonable people who may disagree, but they may not disagree on, like, deep fundamental principles. So mostly, don't we live in a sphere, aren't we mostly surrounded by, you know, more or less reasonable people with oppositional interests, maybe? And it's not really a matter of my principles or nothing. It's like, you know, my interest versus your interest, and we got to find some balance. Isn't it mostly like that, or is that not right?
Well, it's somewhat like that. I wouldn't say it's only about balance. Sometimes we actually do better when we listen to what somebody else's interests are and put them together with ours. For example, when I was a young girl, I would come home, there would be one piece of chocolate cake left, and my mother would do what a lot of people do in that everyday life. She'd cut the cake right down the middle. Until my brother and I were old enough to talk, and I could say to him, "So what do you like about the cake?" And he said, "The cake." And I said, "Great, I like the icing."
Right.
And I'm not making that up. That literally happened. And so we were able to have 100% of our interests. So that's not a really important principle, but we were able to figure out how to put our interests together and do better than we would have done with a very simple get-along.
So sometimes by bargaining with somebody else, we can both be better off. I mean, we can both sort of advance our interests and not give up anything, really. Would we really call that a compromise? Isn't that just kind of realizing mutual advantage in some sense?
Yeah, I think that's right. And I often tell people, negotiation is sometimes about compromise, as you just suggested, and sometimes not. Sometimes we do better by not compromising. But if you thought that everything was a compromise and therefore you didn't even want to talk to the other side, you wouldn't even get there. So I try very hard to get people to stop seeing compromise as necessarily a bad thing.
Well, suppose your brother just said, "What I like about the cake is most of it."
Mm-hmm.
"And I'm bigger than you, so let's compromise, and you can have a third of it, and I won't take all of it, I'll just take two-thirds of it." Would it have been somehow beneath human dignity to agree to such a compromise?
That depends, actually. In the real world, I was bigger, and actually would have been better for me to have less than all of the cake because I needed to lose some weight. And I say that also not jokingly. If you go behind what people say and what they want, and even your illustration of the bigger, tougher, stronger guy, sometimes you might figure out that underneath that, there's another reason, or as you would say, a principle or some interest that would actually put us in a better place. And I could let him have two-thirds of the cake, and if I were clever enough, I would ask him to do something else nice for me in return. That's a compromise.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're discussing compromise, negotiation, and deals with the devil. Our guest is Carrie Minkle-Metal from the UC Irvine School of Law.
Have you bargained with the devil? Who was the devil in that case? An ex-spouse? An ex-business partner? A powerful institution out to screw you? What did you learn? Share your experiences. Join us by calling toll-free 1-800-525-9917.
To compromise or not to compromise, that is the question. Plus, your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
You can work it out with anyone. Well, almost anyone, if you're willing to compromise. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. And this is Philosophy Talk. Have you ever held your nose and compromised your principles? Have you done that with some sort of devil? Was it the right thing or the wrong thing to do? Join the conversation. 1-800-525-9917. Or you can email us at comments@philosophytalk.org.
Our guest is Carrie Menkel-Meadow, author of What's Fair? Ethics for Negotiators.
So, Carrie, we eventually want to ask you about the political compromises, because that's a big topic. But we want to work toward that by starting with more ordinary individual cases. We've talked about, you know, there's lots of times when you can compromise, but we weren't really talking about when something's moral at stake, when you have, like, what are called divergent interests with the other party, and there's a moral issue. What are the moral ground rules for compromising, whether it's with the devil or with your employer or your spouse or maybe even, like, in this case, with your co-host? What are some moral basis of thinking about compromise?
Well, that's a great question, and I would say there are a couple of things. First of all, can you trust the other side? If the other side's not trustworthy, and I think that's one of the things Margulies gets into in his book, should Chamberlain have trusted the negotiators for Hitler? Can you trust the other side? That's a very important moral question, and that has to do not only with principles, but even if you came to a compromise with the other side, could you trust them to actually do what they say they're going to do? Can you believe that they're actually going to do what they say they're going to do? And that's sort of the power to execute and do the right thing. But I would add that our senses of morality are also things that are very both culturally dependent, independent, and part of our individual makeups, and as you say, also political. So there are situations where someone would bargain with someone who one disagreed with morally. And I would say, from an example from my own practice years ago, I was an employment discrimination lawyer, and I bargained all the time with defendants who I thought were discriminating against people, and that in my world is morally wrong. But in one case, for example, when I represented a truck driver who was claiming racial discrimination, and I believe he was right, we wound up getting him his own truck so he could start his own business. And many people criticized me for bargaining with a devilish discriminator instead of settling the case or going to court and getting a principal declared of discrimination. My client got to start a new life. And that was a bargain with something of a discriminating devil, and I thought it was a good bargain.
Let me press this just a little bit more. So I know some people, friends of mine, who I regard tenderly as patrons of the morally superior lost cause. That is, they always want clean hands, and so they will not compromise, even if they're going to be on the losing side, they will not compromise with what they regard as the devil, because there's some moral superiority in that. What do you think about that?
I have to tell you, not much these days. If I can just mention another great philosopher, Marcus Sen, has just written a wonderful book on the idea of justice. And I think he's come to a place where lots of other important people have been, Adam Smith, for example, who said we can argue about the absolutely pure, clean hands good till we're all blue in the face. And it's pretty clear that humanity's not getting there. So in order to move forward and to eliminate bad, so let's look at that, eliminate the negative, get rid of poverty, try to do something about disease, we need to look for good solutions, not the best solutions. We can't always have clean hands to accomplish a good, if not the great. And that's sort of where I am on these questions. I'm looking for the practical good in the best way that we can get there. And yes, it does mean, alas, that sometimes our hands get a little dirty.
Well, Ken mentions these morally superior people. He's been chair of the philosophy department. I was chair of the philosophy department for almost 10 years. And the thing about a philosophy department is there's lots of principles. I mean, almost everything. I mean, moving the men's room door or something like that. There's some principle involved. But for these kinds of principles, there's a lot of compromise possible. They're not really deeply felt. They're often made up on the fly. But sometimes, I mean, like if we're going to compromise with the Taliban, I mean, they don't believe in women's rights. They don't believe in preserving cultural artifacts. They're just despicable, at least by my cultural standards, and I think my cultural standards are right. Can we really bargain away really fundamental principles?
You got me in my very weakest point, because I knew, since we are in fact, not we, but the Afghani government is in fact, as we're speaking, negotiating with the Taliban. Mm-hmm. So you raise a very timely question. And, of course, pointing to women's rights, you raise where my moral principles are. To what extent is it right for us to bargain away the rights of women, to see those horrible pictures on the magazines with people's noses cut off and women being stoned for adultery, which is, in fact, part of the moral system? So I have a couple of reactions to that, you may have heard a lot about the phrase win-win in this work that I'm doing. And I say sometimes we need lose-lose, but nobody dies. And so I guess I'd say for me the ultimate principle is trying as best we can to preserve life as much as possible. Marguerite says we should never bargain with anyone who's establishing or sustaining an inhumane regime. So under his standards, bargaining with the Taliban would probably be wrong. I'm more ambivalent about it because so many people have died uselessly in this war. That I think we can, and I don't, when I say we, actually, I mean the Afghani government, the United States will then have to decide what it's going to do, whether it stays or goes. But I think that the Afghanis have suffered a lot, and it's their country, and it's their culture. And I think that these negotiations probably, in my view, are morally permissible, maybe justifiable if they reduce the loss of life. And it may be very painful for us standing outside of the borders of Afghanistan to watch what may be happening. I say that as a feminist and a person who thinks that women's rights are very, very important, but it's not our country.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about bargaining with the devil with our guest, Carrie Minkle-Meadows, and we'd love to have you join this conversation, 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917, and we've got a caller on the line now, Philip from San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Philip.
Hi, thank you. My question is it advisable to admit to an imaginary wrong in order for a compromise discussion to go forward? By this I mean, if somebody will not talk to you, somebody says that you've done something to them in the past, and that's why they won't talk to you, and that's why they fundamentally don't trust you. But that situation didn't ever really happen. If you have an alternative description of the entire thing and you won't admit to it, is it advisable ever to admit to having done this imaginary wrong in order to be able to talk, to get to the point where you can talk and make a kind of compromise? Or does the nature of that that compromise of the truth undermine the entire possibility of you having a compromise?
That's an interesting question, Philip. I have a suspicion it's not entirely hypothetical, but we'll treat it on a theoretical level.
Well, yeah, I mean, Carrie, I think the question goes to, look, part of when you're negotiating with people is how do we frame the event? I mean, who gets to tell the story of what we're doing in the first place, of who's the bad guy? We're always trying to make the other guy look out the bad guy. And should we worry? I guess Philip is asking, should we worry about establishing the truth, or should we just get on with it and compromise?
Great question. So the first thing I'd say about that wonderful example, which I bet is not hypothetical either, is it talks to us about hierarchies of principles. So if you believe, as your clean hand people would, that truth is the ultimate value, then probably you wouldn't want to admit to something you've never done. And the lawyer in me, of course, says you ought to be careful about what you admit to because it might actually lead to some liability depending on what the event was. But if you're like me, or I should say, and if you're like me, and truth is not the primary value, but justice might be, or relationship might be, if there are other values, then indeed you might, in order to move the conversation forward, to preserve the relationship, to start all over again, there are ways of saying, I hear what you say, I see how you believe that I did this or that, and maybe I can admit to your understanding of it and we can move forward. And so the idea here is to reframe it so you acknowledge the other person's perspective, and you don't necessarily have to admit its ultimate truth, but you can admit that it's the other person's truth.
Get it. True for you for the purposes of this discussion. Mm-hmm. John, you look like you wanted to get in there.
No. An example of that on the international level is the Armenian genocide. The Armenians think it's genocide. Most of the rest of the world thinks it was genocide, but the Turks who committed it don't want to admit to that word, and even though generations have passed and the Armenians the state of Armenia and Armenians who don't live there, and the Turks have a lot of things that they need to cooperate on. It's still at loggerheads, but
it isn't actually. It's not at loggerheads.
Oh, it's not. They're moving forward. Good.
Yes, but let's have broken an agreement in that one.
I want to ask you a more general, abstract kind of question. So, look, when you're negotiating with somebody, you have interests, they have interests. Some of your interests diverge. And mm-hmm. some of your interests converge. And mm-hmm. and I was taught in some management session I once went to, look for the convergent interests and try to first focus on those. Here's the question. Can you really have convergent interests, you know, interests that can be mutually satisfied with, you know, evil? I mean, aren't there some people with whom it's just like, there's no chance of us converging. And so I'm going to walk away. I'm going to fight you. I'm going to resist. I mean, when do you get to that point?
There are certainly situations like that. There are people that one should never negotiate with. I said earlier, and you might look at another example, should we be negotiating with the North Koreans? Should we have negotiated with Hitler? All of those things. It's very easy to demonize and look at someone and say that they're evil. And to bring it closer to home, I know plenty of people who feel that way about their ex-spouses in divorces. I'm never negotiating with that person again.
Right.
So you have to separate the idea of the evil person and the evil acts, and also think about the future. So I'm not saying go off and talk and negotiate and give in to some totally evil person. I am saying be pragmatic. What do you lose if you walk away from that person? Is there something you need from that person? Is that person the parent of your child?
Yeah.
Is that a country that you've got to deal with
so
in the world?
But I still want to press you. So mm-hmm. do you think there's nothing to be said for the clean hand? Suppose I could reach a morally problematic but not morally imperfect and not morally perfect compromise with this person. But still, if I didn't compromise, I'd have clean hands. I wouldn't dirty my hands. Do you think there's nothing to be said for the keep your hands clean principle?
No, I think there's a lot to be said for it. There are wonderful, wonderful people who I admire in the world who have done that. There are lots of leaders you can think about, situations in which Gandhi did that and Martin Luther King Jr. did that. There are people who make having a principle their whole life. And those clean hands people can be our leaders, and they can move us to a better place. So there certainly are situations. And I will tell you, I'll be honest, I'm an academic, too. I've walked out of compromising in my department when it was a very important principle, affirmative action, for example, or some position that a university was going to take with respect to something. For example, since you're at Stanford, this investment in South Africa during the time of apartheid was a big issue, big principled issue on university campuses, and people did refuse to negotiate about that, both on both sides. So I'm not saying that I never would, but I do say, take a look at the other side. What happens when you don't compromise? Does it make it better, or does it make it worse? And that's when I would sometimes talk to an evil person or someone who had done evil things in the past, that there's some potential space for getting to a new place on the other side of that discussion.
Now we've talked about Margalit, and you've reviewed his book at length, and he's got this principle that a rotten compromise is has various features, but the main one is it creates or sustains an inhumane regime. By that standard, a lot of historical decisions that we look back on, maybe with a lot of cognitive dissonance, approvingly, like Churchill and the Founding Fathers, it looks like a pretty rotten compromise. Do you have another principle that you would put in its place that's a little more forgiving?
Great question, because I just want to say that I have always thought that our initial original sin in the United States, and that is the compromise, the great compromise in our Constitution to permit slavery to continue for some time, was absolutely a rotten compromise. We now know that people like even Benjamin Franklin actually tried to prevent that from going into the final document, and I wish he'd been successful. So what I would say, and I think it does explain, unfortunately, the constitutional process, is my principle is a pragmatic one. So I'm a pragmatic person, and on your talk show, I guess you'd call me utilitarian, and that would mean, when is it necessary? When is it necessary in light of more grievous harm? So Margalit and lots of others, and me too, we all look at these things and we judge them post hoc, when the event is over. And I always ask the clean hands philosophers, so what do you think you would have done if you had been in that room with Hitler?
Right. Yeah. You know, that's a very good question. Let's get some more of our callers in here. Michael in Oakland's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Michael. What's your comment or question?
Thank you. It seems to me that true compromise requires some sort of balance, that if you have a situation where one side is has a great advantage and it's balanced toward them, the balance goes toward them, and the other side has much less, either in standing or coercive power or something to offer, then you're really not compromising in some way. The person who is at the shallow end isn't really compromising. There's got to be some sort of parity there for there to be a compromise. So and the person who's on the shallow end is not really compromising. I think that the most obvious example is the Palestinians negotiating with the Israelis when the Israelis are taking most of their land.
Well, you ask a good question, Michael. Kerry, I mean, there is a point. Compromises when there's a sort of balance of power and when there's an imbalance of power are going to be different, but tell me more about that.
Absolutely. Great, great question, and I totally agree with it. And you've actually got me to one of those places where I wouldn't compromise. So without being too glib or flip about it, think about the word compromise. Inside compromise is the word, really, co-promise. So there have to be promises on both sides, and they should be co, meaning they should be together. And as Margalit says, and I agree with that, a compromise which is coerced or forced, or as our caller suggests, pushed on the other side because they have less power and less resources to negotiate, is potentially unforgivable or a bad compromise. So the power relations absolutely matter. And it is true that a compromise that is reached by one party just bullying the other one is not a good one at all. That's why, if I may say, in the Israeli and Palestinian situation, where I have actually done a lot of peace work myself personally, we bring in third parties, mediators. Their job is to try to help the parties negotiate together and try to force out those coerced agreements. A third party stands outside of it, takes a look at it, helps the parties bargain. Sometimes when the United States gets involved, for example, we call that a muscle mediator, someone who adds a little bit of power to one side, to assist one side, to have a little bit more and to equalize the situation.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing Bargaining with the Devil with Kerry Minkle-Meadows, author of What's Fair? Ethics for Negotiators.
We've talked about what's good about compromises and what's bad about compromises. We're going to try to push on by considering some of the really big choices about compromise that have been and will be faced by national leaders.
Compromise, politics, and history when Philosophy Talk continues.
Pajamas. Let's pull the whole thing off. The Philosophy of Compromise. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor, and our guest is Kerry Minkle-Meadows from the UC Irvine School of Law. John, you got an email there for us, right?
Yeah, we have an email from Greg Slater, who I think sent us some intelligent emails in the past, and here's another one. He says, Perry keeps putting up the Taliban as the ultimate evil, but he's being too flippant. You're both being too flippant with the devil. The phrase the devil, remember the Taliban came into power as a reaction to ruthless, murderous warlords who took over Afghanistan after we abandoned it. And he makes a lot of good points and says, it's not so freaking simple, Perry. And I think he makes a very good point. When we talk about compromise, we tend to think of there's the good guys and the bad guys, but actually most compromises are between people that have a mixture of good and bad, and as Kerry was pointing out in the last comment, it takes a third party sometimes to see that. Ken?
Well, we've got a caller on the topic of Afghanistan and the Taliban, too. I thought we'd add him in. Josh in Irvine. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Josh.
Thank you.
And so tell us your comment or question.
Yeah, I had a question for Professor Minkle-Meadows. Given that there are roughly 10 groups that comprise what we call the Taliban, and Iran, Pakistan, and India have a vital interest in the conflict, can you trust the other side to do what they say they are going to do? Do they have the power to do what they say they are going to do? And will it just turn into a lose-lose situation where human rights and women's rights are abandoned and more people die?
So we got two conflicting views here. The let's not over demonize the Taliban. And can we really trust them given the structure of this? What's your thought about any of this, Gary?
Great question. So the caller points out a really important thing for all the listeners to know. There's no such thing as the Taliban. There's a lot of Taliban groups in the region, in Afghanistan and Pakistan, and what the Pakistani Taliban are doing in Afghanistan is related to the Pakistani disputes with India. So we've got a big, complicated mess. And the question is a great one. Can we make a deal with any one part of the Taliban, even if that deal might cause some peace for some people in Afghanistan? Some might live, but others, and many women, for example, might suffer a great deal more. It's a great question because it does relate to compromise. Are we dealing with the devil we know or the devil we don't know? And how many devils are, in fact, in the mix? I would say about this that I think we should talk to whoever President Karzai is talking to. It's some progress. We find out a lot from the other side by talking to them. And I think with the whole world's eyes on the region and the wars that have gone on, I'm a little bit more positive about the notion that deals are not going to be entirely in the back room in the end. They may start in the back room. But this is a region of the world where we're all watching. And I think the eyes of the world will, I suppose, get us to continue to take a look at all the other little feeder groups. They're not so little.
But I want to be a little bit pessimistic here. I understand.
Justified by world conditions, I would say.
I understand that sometimes you've got to bargain with folks you think are really bad. And I understand that after World War II, Churchill, at least, had his army, his generals, investigate what would it take to roll back the Soviet Union from Eastern Europe. And they decided they couldn't do it. So they had to make this bargain that spread, that put Eastern Europe from the frying pan of Hitler into the, well, from the, I don't know, from maybe the fire of Hitler into the frying pan of Soviet domination. Wow. Mm-hmm. And that had huge, huge consequences for a long time. I don't know what would have been better, but I don't know. Just because, okay, you have to reach a compromise, it still may be a really bad outcome. It may be the best of awful outcomes, right?
Possibly, although I would describe that one a little bit differently. I think a sad, but necessary cost-benefit analysis was made that too many people would die if they tried to push too hard to push the Soviets back from Eastern Europe. And so a decision was made not to continue into World War III right out of World War II. And I don't disagree with that decision. And you're absolutely right. Soviet domination was horrible, and many, many other people died. From Marguerite's book, he quotes a figure of 2 million. It was probably even more than that. On the other hand, we can all see what happened after the Soviet domination fell apart, and that is more death and more nationalism and smaller groups of conflict. So I think the jury is still out, if you let me use a lawyer's phrase, at what point we look at the measures of death to determine what the large leader
right.
should be doing with aggregates of people.
I understand that. But that was the setup to my question. Okay, so the World War II was a mess, was this nightmare of the 20th century. And you can see that we had to make these awful bargains, right? We resist mm-hmm. the Nazis, but we helped the Soviets spread. In order to defeat the Nazis, we helped the spread of Soviet darkness. And I hate to be a partisan, but the Soviets spread darkness. Okay,
yeah.
let's grant that. Do we face anything like that kind of thing in contemporary American life? Do our leaders face anything so morally fraught, or are they in an easier situation? I mean, are the Taliban and Al Qaeda that impactful or not?
On some level, the Taliban are far worse to me than the Soviets ever were. Yes, they killed many of their old people, Stalin's purges, all of that. But it was a system of political domination and not freedom. Those are our values. But it's also true that in Yugoslavia, for example, Tito kept a lid on some of the ethnic wars that we've been having now, and there was much less death. Some would say in different forms, greater prosperity. I was there during that period. I think the Taliban are potentially much, much worse. That is, their ideology is quite oppressive to large numbers of people. And on the other hand, it's backed by religious belief. And I do think it is different. It's kind of odd because the United States and the West in general stepped back from Stalin, which was a political ideology, and now we're talking about it in religious terms at a time when the United States says we believe in religious liberty. So they're different situations.
Right. I mean,
and in fact, even more complicated.
Yeah, those when you're bargaining with a person who has religious convictions, which the received voice of God or something tells them they can't be compromised away, that makes it a lot worse, I think, to try and deal with them. But let me ask you another question. Let's go to the domestic agenda. How would you advise Republicans and Democrats? We seem to be in this partisan entrenchment in our politics, right? And the American people keep saying they want bipartisanship and all that, and they never really get it, or when they get it, they're not happy. What would you say to, I mean, the Republicans and the Democrats seem to represent each other as like the devil that ought not to be bargained with. What do you think about that situation?
Yeah, that one's pretty tricky. And so I just want to say I find it sort of interesting that President Obama, who I know actually studied mediation when he was a law student and tried really hard as a community organizer to bring the two sides together, I think tried everything he could to be bipartisan. We also heard it from President Bush. He said he was going to be bipartisan also.
A uniter, not a divider.
Yeah. And unfortunately, our polity looks quite polarized. So I have two quick things to say about it. One is, this isn't the first time we've been in this polarized mess. If you look at the history of political parties in this country, they have been highly polarized since the very beginning of our founding. And you take a look at the Federalists and the polarization that occurred that formed our political parties to begin with. So it's terrible to live through, but it is our history. That's number one. And number two is, I really do wish there was some way to have bipartisanship. The bad part, of course, is it's, again, a very complicated problem. It has nothing to do with the compromises at the high levels where they're trying to make compromise, but a lot of it has to do with very technical things like the way in which our congressional districts are drawn, so that most districts have now become themselves little islands of polarization. And that's a very sad story. And I just wish that all of your listeners would listen to this and would realize that in order to get a little bit of what they want, they are going to have to deal with the other side.
I have a point to make, then I'm going to read an email. The point is just that, well, there is something that goes deep in the American psyche, particularly back to World War II. We had two enemies, and we said we're going to have unconditional surrender. We don't have to compromise. At least that was the sense that the American people got. And I think there is a very unrealistic feeling that even after Vietnam and even after Iraq, that somehow it's un-American to compromise, because we're the chosen country and we're founded on great principles. Now, before you reply to that, I want to read this nice email we got from Nate. Hi, Ken and John, great show. Oh, I like that. Kant has a great quote that reads, "Out of the crooked timber of humanity, no straight thing was ever made." Oh, good for Kant. Reaching for the perfect solution not only seems impossible in our world, but it is just not pragmatic. So there's a deep thought from Kant.
Yay, Kant. I agree with that totally.
Really? So is that to give up on the very idea of moral perfection, though? To say that reaching for the perfect will always be the enemy of the good? Is that just to give up on that idea?
I wouldn't give up on it. I wouldn't make it our first principle. My first principle is do good. Make the best that you possibly can out of a bad situation. And if I can react a little bit to what you said about the American psyche, with which I agree, I'm one of those people who thinks World War II happened because we didn't compromise at all in World War I, and we drove the Axis and the German powers to their knees, and that's essentially what brought Hitler to power. So I think by being too principled, by pushing too hard for those clean, clean lines of winner and loser, all we get is revenge, the desire for revenge, or revanchism, as Margulies describes it. If you beat me too badly, I'm going to come back and get you the next time. And that kind of behavior gets us into trouble, too.
Well, Carrie, you know, you've left us with a complicated stew, because on the one hand, there are the compromises that you should have made, and then there are ones that you shouldn't have made, perhaps, that spread evil by you making them, and the ones that spread evil by you not making them. So life is so complicated. But on that note, I'm going to thank you for joining us. It's been a great conversation, uncompromisingly good.
Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it, too.
Our guest has been Carrie Minkle-Meadow. She's a professor of law from the University of California, Irvine. She's author of What's Fair? Ethics for Negotiators. So, John, what are your uncompromising thoughts today?
Well, I enjoyed the conversation a great deal and preparing for it. As you know, I'm not much of a political philosopher. I like the more difficult and profound parts of philosophy, like philosophy of language, philosophy of mind, adverbs, proper names, things like that. But when I think about it, I mean, I'm I get to the same conclusion talking to Carrie Minkle-Meadow that she came to, and that I always get when I read history, that damn Woodrow Wilson and the idea that America's job in the world is to crusade for principles, that really screwed us up. But that's just my opinion. I'm willing to compromise if you've got a good argument.
No, well, I think over-crusading for principles, bad thing, but under-crusading for them is a bad thing, too. So you got to find the happy middle ground. But on that note, I'll say this conversation continues on our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore, I blog. And we also have this burgeoning Facebook page. You can waste a lot of time and become one of the thousands and thousands of members there.
And while you're at it, download podcasts of our program from our website as well. For the final word, we're going to strike our own devil's bargain with Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, books, movies, television, theater, opera, fairy tales, pop songs, where would they be without Satan? Bluesman Robert Johnson or Tommy Johnson both sold their souls to the devil, it is said, as did Paganini, Homer Simpson, Faust, Dudley Moore, Peter Tork of the Monkees, and somebody or other in every third episode of The Twilight Zone. The most famous real-life example of a man making a pact with Satan is Urban Grandier, a 17th-century priest who was actually burned at the stake in 1634 as a witch. It is acknowledged that Grandier liked the ladies, which became the cause of his problems. A group of nuns, allegedly angry that Grandier had not had sex with them, accused him of having bewitched them. He was acquitted at the subsequent trial, but the powerful Cardinal Richelieu ordered a new trial, in revenge for some unkind words Grandier had written about him. After torturing Grandier, the judges at the trial introduced documentary proof of his evil, a pact, written in Latin, backwards, and signed by various demons, including Satan himself. How are you going to argue against that? The pact said, quote, "And to him do we promise the love of women, the flower of virgins, their respective monarchs, honors, lusts, and powers. He will go whoring 3 days long. The carousal will be dear to him. He offers us once in the year a seal of blood. Under the feet he will trample the holy things of the church, and he will ask us many questions. With this pact he will live 20 years happy in the earth of men, and will later join us to sin against God, bound in hell in the council of demons," unquote. Yours, Lucifer, Beelzebub, Satan, etc. Well, today this seems like a pretty transparent forgery. I mean, in all, seven demons signed the thing. How are you going to get seven demons in one place, anytime, much less to agree on anything? Nevertheless, it sealed Grandier's doom. He never confessed, though he was put to the question, as he said back then. The ordinary question consisted of 8 pints of water being forced into the stomach. The extraordinary question consisted of 16 pints, followed by death. Today, of course, we call this an enhanced interrogation technique, and it's just done wonders for our system of law. Grandier has since been a figure of fascination. Alexandre Dumas the Elder included him in his book about famous crimes and wrote a play about him. 19th century historian Jules Michelet had a chapter about him in his famous work, Satanism and Witchcraft. Aldous Huxley wrote The Devils of Loudun about the saga, which became a Royal Shakespeare Company production called The Devils, which in turn became a lurid and very controversial film in 1971, also called The Devils, directed by Ken Russell with Oliver Reed and Vanessa Redgrave. If there is a moral, I would think it's this. Don't get Cardinal Richelieu mad at you. If there are any repressed hysterical nuns around, have sex with them immediately. Okay, both of those are kind of thin on the ground these days, but here's the most important thing to remember. If you're going to make a deal with the devil, whatever you do, don't put it in writing.
What did the devil give you for your soul, Tommy?
Well, he taught me to play this here guitar real good.
Oh, son, for that you traded your everlasting soul?
Well, I wouldn't use it.
I gotta go.
Ian Scholes, the only man who can solve a philosophical problem in 60 seconds.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Minella Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2010.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Our production coordinator is Devin Strolovich. Our directors of research are Daniel Elstein and Ben Hirsch. Lael Weiss is our webmaster.
Also thanks to Chris Hoff, Merle Kessler, Corey Goldman, and Mark Stone.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and the members of KALW San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.